Over many years, the U.S. and India have grown closer, but President Trump's tariffs against Indian exports are changing that.
If the administration continues in this vein, it is going to lead to a significant rift in Indo-U.S. relations.
I'm Marco Werman. Is that rift starting with India getting closer to China? Also, a tense standoff between rival members of the Greek Orthodox Church.
These people have taken a military approach to securing their existence there, and it's really frightening.
We'll also hear from the only black woman-owned brewery in South Africa.
For centuries, women have been the ones that are brewing beer. It might have been lost somewhere in translation, but we are now reclaiming our place as brewers.
All that and more coming up today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Carolyn Beeler is on assignment in Greenland. It's good to have you here with us today. We begin the show with what seem to be renewed relations between China and India. The two neighbors should be partners, not adversaries or threats. That was a message today from Wang Yi, China's foreign minister, during a two-day visit to Delhi, where he's meeting with India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi. China and India have had a tense relationship, seen especially in a deadly border dispute that's persisted for years. Now there is a change in tone. That's thanks in part to the way U.S. trade policy is hitting both Beijing and Delhi. Shumit Ganguly is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and helped us understand the warmer tenor of Chinese-Indian relations.
China is India's second largest trading partner after the United States. But if the U.S. continues to impose these tariffs, under these conditions, China will very quickly assume the first spot as a trading partner. But any trade deals that India reaches with China are not of long-term consequence. There will be some relaxation of tensions. India will probably resume flights to Beijing and allow Chinese commercial aircraft to fly into New Delhi. But these are merely tactical moves, because India has been trying to reduce its dependence on China. This is simply a fleeting moment of cooperation.
Shumit, India and the United States have developed a much warmer relationship over the years with regard to trade and security. Trump and Modi seem to have gotten along. As you said, Trump has given Modi a deadline at the end of August, though, to get off of Russian oil. So where do you see things headed now between the U.S. and India?
Much depends on what the Trump administration does in the next few weeks and months ahead. If it continues on this pathway of punishing India, it is going to lead to a significant rift in Indo-US relations. And I think, in my judgment, the administration is making a crucial mistake, because at least for the last two decades and longer, India has been a bipartisan issue.
Where do you see the mistake regarding Washington and Delhi? Is it around tariffs?
The mistake I see lies in the abuse of tariffs to induce India to make certain foreign policy changes, and also Trump's repeated claims that he was responsible for bringing about a ceasefire following the skirmishes between India and Pakistan in May of this year. India has a fundamental allergy to third parties intervening in the Kashmir dispute. It is needlessly going to provoke the Indians, and that's precisely what it did.
What about President Trump's pressure on India getting off Russian oil? Does that make sense to you?
No, it does not, because this was something that was agreed upon during the Biden administration and then subsequently blessed, at least tacitly, by the second Trump administration. So Trump's attempts to crudely pressure India to abandon this reliance on Russian oil, I think, is counterproductive in multiple ways.
Shumit, as for China, like, if China were given a choice between the U.S. and India as a first-pick trading partner, assuming reliability on both sides, who would they turn to?
Oh, they turn to the United States because the United States has a much wider market, a much deeper market, one that they are familiar with and one they have flooded. The market in the United States is so much larger. India is a minnow in comparison to the market that they enjoy here.
So finally, Shumi, what challenges are you keeping your eyes on to see how this relationship now develops between India and China?
My strong suspicion is, as long as Trump keeps this pressure up, the Indians will at least make tactical concessions to the Chinese and try and ensure that the Chinese don't stir troubles up along the border. But I think this is a fundamentally flawed strategy. It is likely to work in the short term, but in the medium and long term, this is a disastrous policy.
Shumit Ganguly not holding back there. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. We've been speaking with him about China and India tamping down their differences and trying to build a bilateral relationship. Over the summer, about 24 students became the inaugural graduating class from Ecuador's first public indigenous university. Students and professors say they are finally getting access to higher education that's in sync with their worldviews. In their eyes, the university is poised to have a big impact on the future of the country. Michael Fox has a story from Quito, Ecuador.
It's an early morning Saturday in mid-July. Hundreds of students sit in an outdoor amphitheater in Quito. In the center, flowers, fruits, and vegetables are laid out on the ground, an offering to Pachamama, Mother Earth. This is a meeting of the country's first and only indigenous university. It's called a Maltaihuasi. That means House of Knowledge in Quechua, Ecuador's main indigenous language. Students and teachers have traveled here from around the country for this rare in-person meeting. Most classes are online. Professors say it's the only way to cater to the diverse group of students scattered across the country without uprooting them from their communities. That includes people like Azucena Sanchez. She's studying indigenous language and culture. She took a six-hour overnight bus with 45 other students from the province of Los Ríos. This is really important, she says. I'm so happy to be here and to share these experiences. Sanchez is one of 1,600 students from around the country who are studying in 10 departments at a Maltaihuasi. Courses like tourism, education, sustainable development, community economy, and agroecology. Classes are free. While the degree is official, a Maltaihuasi law professor Daki Lema says their focus is very different from traditional education in Ecuador. For decades, our elders said that we were being taught in a monocultural education system, he says. From early childhood, we were raised with education exclusively in Spanish and from a Western perspective. Lema says a Maltaihuasi is offering a different path, infusing formal higher education with indigenous knowledge, culture, philosophy, and cosmovision. University directors say it's a means of training thousands of future leaders with an indigenous worldview. They have their sights set high. Freddy Simbaña is the school's assistant director for community administration and research.
Este estudiante puede llegar a ser un alcalde en su territorio, un diputado nacional.
This student could become a mayor in their territory or a congressional representative, he says, and they will have political training and organizational capacity for decision-making. Jefferson Peña says he gets goosebumps when he thinks about the first graduates and the many more to come. He's a student leader from the Huauranca tribe who's in his final year at the university. When he graduates, he hopes to teach and develop community projects to strengthen indigenous identity.
Y es todo un grupo de chicos, jóvenes, adultos de diferentes pueblos, de diferentes nacionalidades.
He says a whole group of people from different towns and different indigenous nationalities are going to come out with this knowledge, and that's going to break many deeply rooted stereotypes in society. Indigenous peoples in Ecuador make up roughly 7% of the population, but they have long faced discrimination. Roughly 2/3 of Ecuador's indigenous peoples live in poverty, three times that of whites. Many students at Amaltaiwasi say they would never have had the chance to study higher education elsewhere because of the cost and the distance from their homes.
Como estudiante, para mí se ha sido un logro poder estar en esta.
For me, it's been an achievement just to be in this university, says Hugo Watatoka. He's a communication student from the Amazonian region of Pastaza. Watatoka is in his second year, but he's already using what he's learned. The goal for most students is to take back their new knowledge to their communities. He says, I'm putting into practice the activities I do here at school with the children in the community, teaching all of these communications techniques. Things like video, messaging, and storytelling. But there are many challenges. Amazonian students often can't get online when it rains hard, which often kills the internet. And the school lacks resources for professors and tutors to visit students in communities that are far away and hard to reach. Amaltaiwasi became an official public university only in 2018, but university leaders say it was decades in the making. There are only a handful of colleges like this around Latin America. Amaltaiwasi University Director Armando Muyolema says U.S. institutions could learn a thing or two from his school. Muyolema did his PhD in the United States and led the Quechua language department at the University of Wisconsin for many years.
Pues yo creo que las universidades, pues en Estados Unidos, en todas partes, tienen que abrir, digamos.
He says universities in the United States should try to incorporate indigenous worldviews with a greater focus on the community instead of just the individual. For millennia, Ecuador's indigenous peoples have found ways of living harmoniously with their surroundings. And, he says, people should start to value the knowledge that indigenous peoples have collected if society is to exist for millennia to come. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Quito, Ecuador.
The adventurous musical mind of Jamshid Sharifi has gone quiet. The 64-year-old died on Friday. Sharifi was an award-winning composer born in the U.S. Midwest to an Iranian father and American mother. A connection to Iran, Persian music, and the wider world always guided his work, even when he was commissioned to compose for the 1999 movie Muppets from Space. Sharifi's imagination took his sound to that wider world. His global sensibilities made him a broker for getting music on Broadway that didn't fit the typical mold. Sharifi won a Tony in 2018 for orchestrating the score to the stage production of The Band's Visit.
A book as a loyal companion always.
You know it.
Oh, yes.
Friday evening, Omar Sharif, in black and white and glories routine.
Jamshid Sharifi's stylistic diversity was a gift from having his feet in two cultures. It gave his work universal appeal, one of the reasons he was also in demand by dance music producers. This remix of his composition, Open, for example, by the Bombay Dub Orchestra. Music there from the late Jamshid Sharif, remixed by the Bombay Dub Orchestra. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Brewing beer in many African countries was traditionally the domain of women. At a brewery called Tolokazi in a suburb of Johannesburg, South Africa, young women are learning how to become experts in the craft. A Piwe Nasani Mawela stands by a big metal vat as an amber liquid pours into it, and a group of students observe. This is her brand new Brewster's Academy. When Nasani Mawela opened Tolokazi in 2021, she became the first Black woman in South Africa to own a craft brewery.
I wanted to make sure that that I'm not the first and the last.
That's Nasani Mawela speaking to the AP. She joins our show from Johannesburg. Apiwe, it's really interesting. You're the first Black woman to own a craft brewery in South Africa, and you don't want to be the last, as you said. You're also producing and teaching. What exactly is your mission when it comes to producing beer?
So for Tolokazi, the brand Tolokazi actually is my clan name. So I come from the Tolo clan in South Africa. So the brand name for me is about celebrating women. So Ekazi is a female version within that clan. And in our culture, women are the ones that brew beer, traditional beer. So I wanted to, through everything that I do in the industry, make sure that I celebrate that. And I make sure that people are aware that for centuries, women have been the ones that bring beer. It might have been lost somewhere in translation, but we are now reclaiming our place as brewers.
What you're saying, Apiwe, really scans with something I learned a few years ago. Of course, you know South African musician Vusi Maliseela. He came out with an album called Shabine Queen, Shabine being a neighborhood bar hangout.
Yes.
And this is what Vusi told me about that.
The Shabine Queen, that was my grandmother. She had the skill of brewing the African beer, Umkomboti. And she started selling beer around the people who were working around Mamelodi and Pretoria.
Yeah, so that's a great example of how beer brewing in some African countries, in South Africa, and Vusi Maliseela's own grandmother was a brewer. It was traditionally women's work. So what happened?
Through industrialization, obviously with men being the ones that were working in the factories and the women being left at home to look after the kids. And I think that's where we sort of lost our role as women in the beer making. And I think it's similar, not just in Africa, I think other parts of the world where there's certain areas where women were originally the brewers. And through time, we took the backstage, but there is a globally women across wanting to re-own that space and starting to celebrate who we are as women and who we are as brewers.
And at the upper echelons in South Africa of industrial brewing, at one point anyway, were whites in leadership positions, and how much has that changed?
Yes, unfortunately, I mean, looking at the demographics of the country being majority Black, and then looking at the history of the country with obviously coming out of apartheid, you still have a bit of that legacy where you having more senior positions still being filled by white male. But things are slowly changing, very slowly. And I think that's one of the reasons Brewster's Academy, I wanted to fast track that change.
Yes, a change was not happening fast enough for your taste. So you just decided to accelerate with Brewster's Academy.
Yes.
What kind of beers do you actually make at your brewery?
So I'm also quite passionate about use of African ingredients.
Right.
So my beers, I use sorghum grain with some local barley and local hops. And then I do ciders also, which use 100% South African grown fruits, which is the apples. And then I use a fruit called marula. And then I also use tea, rooibos, hibiscus.
Wow.
Which are all indigenous South African tea. All the beers that I make have to have an element of African ingredient in it.
And I'm curious, how does the taste go over with South Africans who are used to homemade versions of those traditional brews? And probably when they reach for a beer in a bar, they go for a mass-produced lager.
Yes, yeah, so across the continent, there's more the mass-produced lagers. But you'd be surprised that even the traditional beer, a lot of people, because people have moved away from the rural areas and are now based in the cities and have been through the urbanization, a lot of young people growing up don't no longer have access to their grandmothers, you know, and as such, that tradition is not being passed on as it used to. So some of them have never even tried the traditional beer before. So it's for Tolokazi, we are also trying to retain and make sure that our heritage and our traditions don't get lost as we get urbanized and as we progress into the centuries and new times, that we don't forget what is ours and where we come from.
So your students there, are they learning how to make these types of brews, and how excited are they?
A part of the curriculum, which is a strict curriculum, we also allow them to experiment. So they get brew challenges. So every month they get to brew something unique. I encourage them to tap into their creative brains, but at the same time, keeping within the guidelines of what a beer should be. I'm encouraging them to use local ingredients so that they can then come up with different recipes using local ingredients, even outside of what I've been able to do myself, which is they're actually very excited. And some of them have never brewed before. So it's a new world for them, challenging and interesting at the same time.
Very, very cool. You know, we went through this kind of obsession with IPAs, with U.S. microbrews. Finally seem to be moving that aside. What kind of trends are you seeing in South African beer?
So we follow the American trends quite a lot. Yeah, I think you would have had your milkshake IPAs and all these other different styles. So there was a phase in South Africa. We were also seeing quite a lot of those. And sour beers are currently also kind of on a comeback. But you can never go away from having a good, clean, crisp lager. And what we find is that people are obviously playing around with the lager style. We had a bit of the non-alcoholics, but it didn't pick up as much.
You know, it's interesting that no alcohol beer is not catching on in South Africa, because it does seem to be kind of gaining traction in other places, including the U.S. So are there some trends in the U.S. that you just are not going to follow?
No, we did try. I think our consumers were not ready for that trend, but I think it's a global trend where consumers are moving towards more healthier options and more lower alcohol. So I do think that maybe with time, maybe not now, it will pick up.
Final question, Apiwe, the local ingredients in some of your brews, any possibility of exporting in the near future?
At the moment, what I've been working on is more collaboration brews. So last year, I actually brewed a Marula farmhouse ale in Belgium using the Marula fruit. So that's the plan or the strategy we want to try, to say, how do we get the ingredients, the beers out in the world, but without having to brew in South Africa and send out, but you bring with local brewers in the different regions and merge the different brewing cultures to create unique beers and unique styles. Because as you know, to ship liquid across the oceans can be a bit pricey. And yes, and all, obviously with all the tariffs that have been imposed, it makes it more difficult. But I think for me is looking at, you know, working with like-minded brewers who are looking at exploring, and collaborations is key. And as you had said earlier, I mean, the world is also becoming too small now. We are all one. I'm talking to you across from South Africa. So to have a brewer, to brew a beer similarly, should not be that difficult.
Apiwe Nasani Mawela is the founder of Tolokazi Brewery in Johannesburg, South Africa.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For more than 50 years, a group of Greek Orthodox monks have barricaded themselves in a monastery in eastern Greece, refusing to leave. The Greek Orthodox Church says it owns a building, and it, along with local courts, have tried to evict the monks. An incident back in May actually left one of them hospitalized. The World's Duri Buscarin reports on the rebel monks of Mount Athos.
On May 22nd, a Greek Orthodox monk went out to work in a flower bed. According to monastic authorities, two men from a rival monastery came up from behind him and attacked him with garden tools. The victim was hospitalized, but later released. Archon Elias Damianakis calls it a murder attempt.
These people have taken a military approach to securing their existence there. And it's really frightening.
Damianakis is an iconographer, or religious painter, for the Greek Orthodox Church. While the accused monastery claimed the attack was faked, Damianakis says it's the latest in a string of events between two rival brotherhoods that claim ownership of Isphigmenou Monastery.
No monk owns a monastery. Even the abbots, they don't own it. They take care of it.
The two brotherhoods live side by side. One is recognized by the Greek Orthodox Church and lives in a small section of the monastery still under their control, creating a situation that is ripe for conflict.
They share a wall, so they could be sitting back to back. The wall is there, and the legitimate brotherhood is suffering under very limited and confined living conditions.
The Isphigmenou Monastery is part of Mount Athos, an autonomous holy mountain of some 20 monastic communities, as significant to Orthodox Greeks as Vatican City for Catholics. The monastery is this hulking 10th century structure on the shore of the Aegean Sea. Famous saints have come from there.
It's a treasury, a repository of Christianity's inheritance. And when you go to Mount Athos, you see paintings from the 8th century, 9th century, all the way to contemporary, a nonstop chain of constant tradition.
Until the schism of Isphigmenou. The brotherhood that currently occupies the monastery declined an interview, but you can see glimpses of their lives through their TikTok account.
They just wanted to do their own thing, to pray. And pray in their own way, and they don't want to be bothered.
John Rigas acts as spokesperson for the Brotherhood. He says that in 1972, the monks of Isphigmenou broke away from the Greek Orthodox Church and decided to no longer honor its patriarch. They were upset that the church had changed to the modern Gregorian calendar in use today, and they opposed Greek Orthodox leaders, reforging ties with the Catholic Church.
That calendar was the main issue. Why? Because it splits the church. It divides the church.
Rigas says the monastery belongs to the monks who live there, and they have proof.
Every monastery on Mount Athos has its own document, its own deeds, let's put it that way, for the monastery. The deeds from the 1400s. And they own the monastery, the brotherhood.
After declaring the monks of Isphigmenou were no longer part of the church, Greek Orthodox leaders began trying to evict them from the building through the Greek court system. Since then, Rigas says, life there has been full of daily injustices.
They turned their electricity off, and they turned it off because they say they don't need it. Well, they don't need the electricity anyway. They have candles.
Rigas claims church leaders have seized the monks' mail, including their social security checks, that it pressures supply trucks not to go to Isphigmenou, forcing the brothers to carry in food on their backs. When they go fishing in the waters in front of the monastery, church authorities call the Coast Guard. Even seeing a doctor is hard.
They can't go to a doctor. Doctors can't come in. If they find out they're coming to go to Isphigmenou, they won't let them in, you know.
The leadership of the Greek Orthodox Church in Istanbul, known as the Ecumenical Patriarchate, did not respond to multiple requests for comment on these allegations. After Greek courts refused to evict the monks, police have made repeated attempts to seize the monastery. They were pushed back by Isphigmenou monks throwing stones and Molotov cocktails. For now, the standoff continues. On a recent visit to Mount Athos, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis appeared to reference the conflict, saying the Greek government would stand by the Orthodox Church on Mount Athos and announcing a 100 million euro assistance package for monastery maintenance. But supporters like Elias Damianakis fear the clock is ticking and that the brotherhood that controls the building is selling off religious art and relics to pay the bills.
And the Greek government is really obligated, required to protect the peninsula, and they're failing to do so. They're failing to fulfill their constitutional duties.
He says it's a humiliation for the monastery's ownership to remain unresolved. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin.
The old wooden church in Kiruna, Sweden, is much loved. Now, the church is literally on the move. With a prayer, the church rolled away this morning, straddling two giant trucks with a massive purpose-built frame between them. It's traveling 3 miles total. Engineers had to widen a major road so it could fit and dismantle a viaduct in preparation.
Today, it's a historical day here in Kiruna. We are moving our fantastic church. We are going to move it 5 kilometers in total.
Therese Lindroth spoke with the Associated Press. She's with the state-owned company that runs the world's largest underground iron ore mine. As the mine expanded deeper over the past couple of decades, Kiruna residents started seeing cracks in buildings and roads.
The land where the church lays down right now is affected by our mining operations.
So to prevent the town and the church from being damaged further, officials are moving buildings to a new location, including that church. A driver using a large control box is piloting the trucks. There is a pause each day for fika, the traditional Swedish afternoon coffee break. You know, some traditions must be observed. Moving these buildings has become something of a free show. Big crowds of tourists and a good number of the town's 23,000 residents were out watching today, including Johan Arveli and Frida Albertsson.
I've been waiting for this for a couple of years, so we came yesterday, and I didn't know what to expect. I had to see it, because it's a weird thing, and a big thing.
I was very nervous for the church moving, because, well, it's a big thing happening. I was worried that it was going to fall apart, but it didn't, so I'm very happy.
Kiruna is Sweden's northernmost city. It's 124 miles above the Arctic Circle, known for the midnight sun, the northern lights, and the ice hotel. The Kiruna Church was built in 1912 by the mining company. Its neo-Gothic exterior makes it the town's most distinctive building. Not everyone is thrilled about the expansion of the mine. The chairman of one of the Sami organizations, Kiruna's indigenous population, says the new mine could threaten reindeer migration routes and imperil the livelihood of herders in the area. By the way, over the next day or so, you can watch the Kiruna Church being moved. There's an online feed from Swedish TV called The Great Church Walk. It shows the building moving along at half a mile an hour, with live commentary, too. Like I said, it's a show. On the west side of Chicago, the ethnic enclave called Greektown goes back to the 1800s. Chicago has a Chinatown, too, on the south side. Not long ago, there was also a Japantown. It wasn't actually called that, but the Lakeview neighborhood had a cluster of Japanese bars and restaurants, food markets, and the Toguri Mercantile, selling everything from kimonos to pottery. A listener asked the Curious City program on public radio station WBEZ what happened to Chicago's only Japanese enclave. Catherine Nagasawa has a story, which includes some troubling history and offensive language.
The reason the Lakeview neighborhood disappeared is complicated. And part of it has to do with how Japanese Americans got to Chicago in the first place. They didn't come by choice. The U.S. government forcibly relocated 20,000 Japanese Americans to Chicago during World War II. And that group was pressured to shed their ethnic identity, their language, and their culture in order to survive. That story doesn't start in Chicago. It starts on the West Coast in the 1940s.
December 7th, 1941. No American will ever forget this Sunday morning in Hawaii. High overhead, Jap raiders are on the loose. Without warning, they circle Pearl Harbor and the city of Honolulu. A surprise attack born of infamy.
It was the beginning of World War II. Approximately 120,000 Japanese Americans were living in what were called Japantowns on the West Coast. These were essentially Japanese neighborhoods, similar to other immigrant neighborhoods around the country. But with the threat of an invasion from Japan, the U.S. government was worried about the loyalty of the highly concentrated West Coast Japanese Americans. So they incarcerated them in what were later called internment camps around the country.
We are protecting ourselves without violating the principles of Christian decency.
But keeping 120,000 people locked up was expensive, and the country needed workers. So after a couple years, the government changed its focus to reintroducing Japanese Americans back into society. Researcher Laura Fujikawa says the government didn't want Japanese Americans to return to the Japan towns they left on the West Coast. They wanted them to spread out and assimilate.
The government told them that part of the reason you ended up in these camps was because you hung out with your own kind.
They were basically saying, you're too Japanese. So when the government allowed Japanese Americans to leave the camps, they set specific conditions. One, they closed the West Coast to Japanese for the duration of the war. And two, they forced them to answer a series of questions about loyalty before they were allowed out.
So one of the questions said, you have to promise that you're not going to hang out with other Japanese Americans.
They also told them to avoid speaking Japanese and to develop, quote, American customs.
So the government says, we'll let you go as long as you stop acting what we think of as Japanese and as long as you integrate into the society.
So how do we get from the camps to Lakeview? Well, in 1943, the government chose Chicago as the first city to pilot their vision for Japanese assimilation. They believed Chicago would be more tolerant to Japanese Americans. Unlike the West Coast, Chicago didn't have the same pre-war racial prejudice towards the Japanese, since there were so few of them living in the city at the time. And when they first arrived, Japanese Americans found it was easy to find jobs in Chicago's light industries, like garment manufacturing, bookbinding, and candy factories.
So you get a job at McClure's, you can get a job at Curtis Candy, you can get a job at Baby Ruth. All these places wanted Nisei because they're good workers.
That's Ross Serrano. He was born in a camp and just a couple years old when his family arrived in Chicago, along with a wave of 20,000 other Japanese Americans. Hirano says his family, along with many others, received housing assistance from the government and other local agencies. To encourage assimilation, the government made sure to settle people in different neighborhoods on the south and near north sides.
So there wasn't any clustering. It was sort of you understood what you had to do. You had to basically be unseen.
But once the government stopped paying attention, Japanese Americans did begin to cluster together, moving out of the south and near north sides. By the 1960s, the biggest cluster was in Lakeview, between Belmont and Addison Streets. Lakeview was thought of as safe and affordable. And it was close to white middle-class neighborhoods, which was in line with the government's directive to assimilate into the dominant American culture. To understand what it was like to grow up in Lakeview and why the neighborhood disappeared, I met a group of people who grew up in the area. We went to the same place you heard about earlier, the Nisei Lounge Bar, one of the last establishments still left from that era. They're from a generation that was shaped by the government's efforts to force assimilation. You can see traces of it in the first names their parents gave them. Ken Funemura, Elaine Kaneshiro, Mike Higa, and Tracy and Linda Oishi. But as kids, they weren't really aware of everything their parents had gone through to get to Chicago and Lakeview. They just knew it was a nice place to grow up. But looking back, the group said they now see that their very American childhoods came at a cost for their parents, who had been traumatized by the war and resettlement. Here's Linda Oishi and Mike Higa.
I mean, my dad was like, you know, you guys are 100% American. Don't ever forget it. We were also striving to break away from the stigma of the war, subliminally.
My father-in-law actually went so far as to tell his children, you are not going to learn Japanese. And they wanted to assimilate so badly that they actually went to that extreme. And they probably lost a little bit of history doing that.
I mean, not that we were blaming ourselves or feeling, you know, responsible. It's like we were totally identified as being the enemy. Other ethnic groups were not identified, like the German Americans or the Italian Americans. They were not identified as being the enemy. It was because of our faces. So you can't get away from that. You know, you can't run away from that.
But there was a way to try to get away from it, and that was to do what the government wanted the Japanese to do in the first place, achieve white middle-class markers of success.
And I think that that was also a part of what happened to this generation as far as we got to move on and get out of the stereotype, to go into professions that required higher education, doctors, lawyers. I mean, that was really going to be revered.
Nearly every Japanese-American family in Lakeview in the 70s could trace their roots back to World War II and the camps. And the pressure to assimilate that started in the camps meant the children of the detainees, the kids that grew up in Lakeview, they didn't stick around. Here's Tracy Oishi.
So as they took higher education, they left to follow careers and, you know, and moved.
When you look at that post-war generation that grew up in Lakeview, you find professionals dispersed throughout the city and suburbs, a group that a recent study found have the highest level of intermarriage to whites of any Asian ethnic group. I wanted to know, what was the cost of all of this? I asked everybody how their experiences might have been different had there been less pressure to assimilate, and if there was still a neighborhood to anchor the community. Linda Oishi feels like, in that case, she might have felt like she didn't have to make a choice between being Japanese or being American.
Would we have to decide? Are we American first or are we Japanese first? And what do we push? Do we push our culture, which is, you know, Japanese language, dancing, music? I mean, we have all these wonderful art things, pottery, kimono making, all this stuff that is just being lost through the third and fourth generations. I don't want that to die. I want it to be part of my kids and my grandkids. But how do you do that?
Without strong ties to Japanese culture, or a neighborhood like the one that used to exist in Lakeview, it's harder to do that. But Elaine Kaneshiro says it's possible. It just requires effort. As she's gotten older and reflected more about what her family lost during the war and in the camps, she says it's been more important for her to seek out other Japanese Americans, even if there's no neighborhood.
I am still part of a Japanese community here in Chicago. And in that setting, I am very comfortable. There's still, even though we don't see each other a lot, there's a commonality there. There's a connection there that is important to me. So I think there's a community. Maybe it's not geographic.
Sure enough, a couple weeks after I spoke with the group at the Nisei Lounge, I saw Elaine Kaneshiro at an event there.
Can I get you a beer, a glass of wine or something?
No, actually, I'm fine.
It was a fundraiser for a local project that sends young Chicago Japanese Americans on a pilgrimage to one of the incarceration camps in California, a way of reconnecting to that history. For a few hours, the lounge was filled with Japanese Americans across generations. Third-generation Sanseis drinking old-style beer with fourth-generation Yonseis. They live all across Chicago and in the suburbs. But when it came time for this scattered community to choose a place to meet and think about history and heritage, they chose the Nisei Lounge, right at the center of the old neighborhood in Lakeview. For The World, I'm Catherine Nagasawa, Chicago.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The high-stakes diplomacy on Friday and yesterday have had many of us focused on the fate of Ukraine. For many Ukrainians living abroad, Russia's invasion of their country became a moment of reevaluation. Fima Chupakin, for example, he's a Ukrainian jazz pianist based in New York and started to rethink where he felt most at home and what he thought about being Ukrainian. The World's Daniel Hoffman brings us his story of how music shaped Chupakin's life and his identity.
When I met Fima Chupakin, one of the first things that jumped out about him is that he loves to laugh, even when I just asked him to introduce himself.
My name is Fima, just like the organization, but spelled with an I. I guess that's my proper introduction.
The other thing that you'll notice is Chupakin's passion for music. That passion, he says, started at an early age.
There was a tiny toy piano in our apartment. I just remember banging on the keys. I'm like, oh, it produces sound. Great. Ah. Maybe I was so annoying that, like, my mom would, like, oh, my God, kiddo. All right, let's get him to a music school so he'll be out of the house and doing this, not on a toy piano, but maybe on the real thing.
Chupakin says he doesn't come from a musical family, but his mom, Larisa, liked listening to music at home. Sometimes she would listen to the Beatles, but she mostly listened to pop songs like those by the most famous Soviet pop star, Alla Pugacheva.
She would, like, often sing two of the songs. One was Million Алых Роз, another one was like, Call Me, Позвони Мне, Позвони, something like that. So at the time, I feel like that was common for almost every household.
But Chupakin says he didn't just grow up with Soviet pop songs. He says his mom listened to Ukrainian music as well.
She just loved the idea of Ukraine. She always loved Ukrainian music. She would sing Chervona Ruta. It's like one of those songs, aside from Alla Pugacheva, that she would sing rather often. Chervону руту не шукай вечорами, ти у мене єдина тільки ти.
Chupakin says when he was in music school, he'd listen to any music he could get his hands on. In the early 90s, when Ukraine became independent, and all the way to the early 2000s, he gravitated towards rock. He'd listen to Nirvana, but also Ukrainian bands like Vopli Vidaplyasova. Vesna, 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 Pride, Vesna, 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 For Chupakin, music became not just his focus, but also a way to get out of Kryvyi Rih, the city in central Ukraine where he grew up.
It's an industrial town. You know, it's like people work at a factory, a couple mines that are still working. It's like dirty, you know, we had like rains that are like dusty, some kind of sparkling dust. That was our rain because steel factories.
Within that industrial jungle, though, there were some opportunities to break out. Famously, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is from Kryvyi Rih, and that's where he got his start as a comedian well before going into politics. Around that time, when Chupakin was a teen, his piano skills began to rapidly improve.
When I practiced, I would open the doors. So we had a little balcony. We had like a sort of a backyard, courtyard where children hang out. Adults hang out, people take drugs, you know, everything. People drink alcohol. Well, entire courtyard would listen to music and they would scream, "Yo, Fima, come on, give us some Queen, man." I think I liked people's attention and I liked the idea that people enjoyed me practicing because at the time I started playing a little better, you know what I mean?
Chupakin says that everything he has in life is because of music, and the music took him places. It took him to a music conservatory in Kharkiv, and later, in 2012, it brought him to the United States when he was granted a Fulbright scholarship. By that time, Chupakin's main musical obsession was jazz.
Jazz became like the music that I felt, wow, I can be so free in this music. Oh, and like somehow it had this aura of hipness to me. I wanted to be hip, I guess, you know, and like what was a hip thing, playing jazz, yes.
Chupakin soon became immersed in the New York jazz scene, while also maintaining a strong connection with Ukraine. He'd often travel back and forth. He was always working, teaching, playing live, composing soundtracks, and producing albums. By 2022, Chupakin had been living in New York for nearly a decade. That was also the year when Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
We just like started call all our friends, asking what's happening. And ever since that, I'm like living this kind of like double life that I feel like on the outside, I'm like friendly and smiley and whatever. But like sometimes deep down, it's like it's getting hard because I feel like I'm in this kind of limbo in between.
In between the U.S. and Ukraine, Chupakin says he realized that his life was centered in New York. For about a year, beginning with the full-scale invasion, he said on many levels it was hard for him to function in the U.S. His mind was always in Ukraine.
Because I physically and geographically live here, it doesn't mean that I'm intending to lose any kind of connections. No, it's actually even grew stronger.
Just recently, Chupakin's band, the Fima Trio, came out with its debut album called Hymn for the Fallen. This is the title track.
It's my own reflection on what's been happening in my country, in the world, with me. Maybe some of the dreams have fallen. Maybe some of the plans did not realize. But also, so many people died. But not getting too dark, though, this track, to me, it's more uplifting because I believe that whatever dies then grows.
Chupakin says that at this point, many Ukrainians have learned to live with the reality of Ukraine still being at war. Sometimes, he says, it drifts into the background, and yet it's always there. With the release of the new album, Chupakin says he's trying to slow down and acknowledge his sense of accomplishment and think about how far his music has taken him. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
Is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Alisa and Mike Wilson, Carol Bushka, Eugene G. Park, Lisa and Peter Krause, Ricky Etherly, and Robert Lang. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.